This is G'day World 267, where my guest is Mr. John Butterworth, the CEO of AMIA, the Australian Interactive Media Industry Association. Stick around, kids.
We have a legacy of freedom and privilege, which has been won by hard struggle, hasn't been given by from above. It's been won, but we have it, and we can use that to help people who are suffering seriously if we try.
Well, the singularity is a future time which will be profoundly transformative, where the machine intelligence we're creating will be billions of times more powerful than our own biological intelligence.
Well, I'll ask you, what's next for Robert Scoble? What do you think you're going to be doing 3-4 years from now?
Oh, geez. We'll have a successful launch of Longhorn. I want to stick around with Microsoft for at least 4 more years.
Around what I call the because effect rather than the with effect. In other words, I can make more money because of my blog than with my blog.
Anything of this magnitude only happens because enormous numbers of people want it to happen and are willing to commit time and energy and money.
Cameron.
John, how are you, mate?
Good, mate. How you doing?
Good. You ready for a chat?
I am indeed.
All right. Well, where will we start, John? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Cameron.
The Australian Interactive Media Industry Association. What does it do, John?
It is the industry representative body for a great deal of things to do with digital media and digital content. It's a very broad organisation. We represent people working in digital media from everything from the military through to the big obvious ones like Google, Yahoo, News, Foxstar, and then a whole range of web development companies and web content and mobile content companies in between.
When you say you represent them, to who and over what?
We represent them to the broader business community. The idea is that we're trying to grow the digital media industry by providing a framework for it and providing advocacy for it. But more importantly, a lot of our activities and services are aimed internally within the industry to help it grow. And that's everything from providing training, access to legal advice, by running forums exploring new business models, by providing even sort of boring things like liability insurance programs. So a lot of our work is quite grassroots, and it's about growing the companies within the industry and the industry as a whole.
What about for startup media companies like the Podcast Network, for example? What can you do for us?
Look, without paraphrasing John F. Kennedy too far, AMIA is more about what you can do with AMIA. The organization itself is relatively small. There's only 5 full-time staff. However, we've got a lot of friends. There's a lot of AMIA members who volunteer their time, often for projects that are basically designed to develop the industry. Now, from a startup perspective, and we have quite a number of them, or for companies that are still quite small, it's really about getting access to business opportunities through the various sort of networks that we have. And a lot of our services are geared towards taking companies that are still in sort of the early stages up to the next level. So in many respects, it's all about providing a community for the players in the industry and the companies in the industry and people who are interested in the industry to get together and work out new opportunities.
So this is like at your events. It's a networking opportunity. Is that mainly what it is for a startup?
It's networking opportunities. It's a way of finding staff, for example. So we run internship programs. We have job boards. We do a lot of events which are very geared towards the business side of running businesses in the industry. We do mentorship programs, so we sort of seek to try and provide as much assistance to the industry, whether large or small, as we possibly can. And the good news is we get a lot of help from the larger companies, which then translates through into the activities that we provide for the smaller ones.
Okay. Well, I guess I've been running TPN now for 2.5, almost 3 years, and I haven't really spoken to anyone from AMIA. I haven't been to an AMIA event, haven't heard it mentioned much. Is it Sydney-centric, or is there a fair bit of stuff happening in Melbourne as well?
Unfortunately, one of the places where there hasn't been a lot happening has been in Melbourne. If anything, AMIA is South Australia and Sydney and New South Wales and Queensland-centric at the moment.
Right.
Because of the sheer amount of activity in those three markets. Now, Sydney's always going to be the largest sort of area of aim of activity, simply because I think it's about 60% of our membership is based in New South Wales, and most of that's in Sydney. But I'd highlight South Australia as another state where there's a lot of activity in the digital media sector, and AMIA is very much a big part of that. And to a lesser extent in Queensland, where the focus seems to be more on sort of software products, but one of the key aspects of activity in the state chapters is the tendency for the government to support the activities of the industry. And that's particularly true of South Australia and Queensland. And I'm delighted to say, as of next week, Victoria as well, thanks to Multimedia Victoria coming to the party with AMIA activities in that state. So you may not have seen as much of it in Melbourne as we'd like, but I'd say you see a lot more of it.
Now, I probably wouldn't have seen much because I'm not a member. It costs $660 for a business to become a member.
Correct.
That's a lot of hooch, man.
But
for a startup.
For a startup, and a lot of startups usually start off by becoming individual members. We've had quite a few of those when they've built their business up large enough, will start to move up into the business range. I mean, we do have to try and draw our money from somewhere, and in terms of membership fees, if we make them too high, then obviously, as you say, you know, it's a bit much for a startup. If we make them too low, we can't actually do very much. We don't get any government financial support outside of the export activities that we run through our TradeStart program. So we are very much dependent on our members to pay their fees so that we can do all the things that we do.
So if the individual membership's $165, and for that, I'm just reading off your website, I get access to invitations to networking events, newsletters, access to online resources and discussions, product and service discounts. What kind of product and service discounts do I get for my $165?
They come and go periodically, but it's, for example, the insurance program that we run is discounted for AMIA members. And from time to time, we'll be approached by people with wanting to offer sort of, you know, discounts to the membership. We are very selective about the sorts of products that we take on board for those sorts of things, because a lot of it we just perceive as not being relevant or not the sort of thing that a digital media industry body would be providing.
Hmm.
But if you're looking to get contracts from sort of larger clients who start talking about, have you got professional liability, that can actually get quite expensive, and you ain't going to win the contract without it. So we spent 2 years putting together an insurance program specifically for digital media companies that was designed to be affordable enough that companies could take it up and start winning those bigger contracts.
And obviously you get to be included in the AMIA Awards, which the last one was run in March. When I look through the award winners, it seems to be heavily weighted by larger companies, larger organisations, you know, the Telstras of the world, big ad agencies, that kind of stuff. Do you feel that it's, do you think it's fairly representing the spread of people working in the digital media space in Australia?
Look, we do. There's a natural tendency for the larger companies to submit more entries because they're doing correspondingly more work and reckon they've got more like to enter into it. I mean, certainly the categories reflect the sheer breadth of the industry here in Australia, and the AMIA Awards is probably one of the few times you ever get to see the entire spectrum of the industry at once. And we're so used to seeing, depending on where you work in the industry, a particular part of it. So if you work on the advertising side, then you'll see that. If you work in e-learning, you'll see that. So the thing we like about the AMIA Awards is that because of the way the categories are structured, it's very representative across the board of the sorts of activities that people are getting into. But there will always be a, as with any awards, a preponderance towards, you know, the larger guys that are more active. But you'll see plenty of not necessarily household names that will pop up in this.
Can you give me an example of one?
Yeah, just having a look at. For example, some of the sort of smaller agencies have been doing the work for Canteen, the Visual Jazz, who did the Defence Force stuff. I mean, these are not sort of household names. The people who did the Navy recruiting site, Clinica Media, not somebody you'd normally sort of associate with, the industry from an outsider. And then you will have, of course, some of the sort of the large ones for the categories that are more towards interactive television and advertising.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be, as I said before, lots of. If I look down the winners list, there's lots of references to Telstra and Fairfax and these sorts of companies.
Oh, look, absolutely. Yeah, some of the categories will attract entries from those areas. I mean, Best Classifieds, is a very good example because most classifieds businesses tend to be sort of larger and owned by major players.
You know,
but equally, people like the Wool Corporation are not sort of somebody that you normally, anticipate seeing in a digital media context.
Mm. So let's talk about the state of digital media in this country. I mean, there's been lots of talk on this show and across the blogosphere, the Australian blogosphere over the last year or two about the state of the digital industry here and how it's not exactly conducive to startups or genuine innovation for a whole bunch of reasons, ranging from a dearth of venture capital or angel funds through to the size of the marketplace. It's still relatively small.
Correct.
From your perspective as the CEO of AMIA, what do you think the state of the nation is in terms of digital media in Australia?
To me, the benchmark for all this is the successful exporting opportunities that we've seen in digital media. We've probably got a unique view because we run a specific program called Trade Start, which is all about taking up-and-coming digital media companies overseas. And over the last 4 years, we've put 200 companies through this program. And last year alone, the export sales generated from those companies was upwards of $20 million, which I know may not sound a lot, but in terms of the Australian digital marketplace, and these are just the ones that we assist. The quality of digital content in this country is evidently good, very good by world standards, given the propensity for overseas markets to buy it. And quite often within Australia, you just won't see that from a locally based perspective. So, having said that, I agree completely with all the comments that are made about the barriers to sort of success in this market and the size and the future growth potential of digital media in the country. We've got a few obstacles to overcome here.
Let me ask you for advice then. I mean, from TPN's perspective, I don't know how much you know about TPN, but we've got 500 odd thousand listeners now or mm-hmm. watchers to our content every month, but 88% of those are outside of Australia. And when I'm talking to media buyers or advertising agencies in this country about taking advantage of that, I still find that they're very geographically focused. Anything that any audience that sits outside of Australian shores, it seems to be anathema to any of the advertising industry or digital media industry people that I talk to in this country. Why is that? Why hasn't the industry caught up with the fact that we're now living in a global media environment and it's not really about what happens just inside of your own shores?
It's partly historical and structural, particularly when it comes to the advertising industry, because advertising has traditionally been sort of a territory-by-territory proposition, mostly to do with cultural differences between different regions, and the advertising industry, like the broader industry, broader business community generally, is still coming to grips with what has been a fairly dramatic change and growth in the way that the world operates. So there'll still be a tendency, for the same reason that a media buyer in Singapore probably isn't going to include Australia on its media buying schedule, is the specificity of the products to a particular market. Now, I think in your case, you're probably a bit unusual for them, and trying to find products within Australia, assuming you're talking to Australian media buyers, that would have appeal outside of the Australian market would be as much the problem as anything else.
But come on, there's got to be a lot of Australian companies that have a product or a service that is relevant to a global audience, or at least a UK, USA, Australian audience. Yet I don't seem to find many people in the advertising industry that are thinking about, well, how do we go out and reach those people globally? They seem to still be locked into this mindset of needing a marketing director in each country. There's not that much difference between Americans, Australians and Aussies, really, is there?
Well, probably between sort of the US and Australian markets, evidently not, given how much of our sort of culture seems to be driven by it. Quite frankly, though, a lot of the products are different in each country. And really, if you're going to go and sell your products overseas, I mean, unfortunately, still the best way seems to be able to get on a plane and make the personal connections and get over there. We've certainly found this with all of our export activities through our TradeStar program. So I think it's a way off yet before we have truly sort of multinational campaigns. I mean, you don't see too many of them from a television or, you know, radio or print perspective. TV commercials being possibly one of the few exceptions, because the American ones get shown here.
Yeah.
But again, it's got to be about products that are actually sold here, or Australian products that are actually sold overseas. You don't want to advertise a product that isn't applicable to a particular culture.
Mate, you and I have been working in the net now since... When did you join Aussiemail? 95?
96. I've passed my 10-year anniversary. I'm now to year 11.
So we're... You know, we've been doing this thing now for over a decade. You know, we really are... We should be a decade into the thinking now, and the corporate change of thinking about global reach, global marketing, global positioning for a lot of this sort of stuff. You know, all of the advertising that we run on TPN today comes out of the USA and the UK. There seems to be plenty of companies in the USA and the UK that have no issue with the fact that they're delivering a global product to a global marketplace. And I'm sure there are smaller companies, a lot of, you know, Web 2.0 companies, for example, software companies, digital companies that have a product or a service that gets built and shipped out of Australia and has a massive global audience. You wouldn't even know that it was Australian unless you drilled down deep enough into their website to figure it out. So, I mean, there are definitely companies out there that do get this, but they seem to be smaller companies rather than larger companies, I guess.
Correct, and they tend not to have the massive, great big advertising budgets that the advertising industry understands and is used to. Industries are inherently conservative once they get to a certain sort of size and age. It's like human beings, actually. So the advertising industry is exactly the same. They're used to consumer... branded products, and the nature of sort of the digital world tends to fragment that, and frankly they find it a bit frightening, because where once they could just go and buy a 30 second television spot, and you know, that was all it took, and now they're faced with having to do these very complicated media buys across a whole range of different distribution channels, including things like the podcast network, with all sorts of sort of management and control issues for them. So it's certainly a harder world for a traditional advertising mind to get its head around. So all I can do is counsel patience here. I mean, they will get there. It's only been sort of 12 years since we've really had a commercially available web, which is in the history of evolution of history is not very long. So there is an element of sort of trying to encourage the rest of the world to catch up. And this is particularly true in Australia, where you've got a smaller population and a smaller market, which tend to sort of inherently be more conservative. And we've seen that with the venture capital community here. And to give an example of another sort of impact on the growth of digital media in Australia, which has a lot to do with both a sort of cultural conservatism when it comes to investing sort of money, and just the simple size of the market means there's not as much money floating around.
Yeah. You know, we've continually seen this brain drain over the last decade. You know, back early, in the early days, we had the Look Smart guys, and we saw Aussiemail raise funding over in the US. And continually what I see with a lot of my colleagues running digital startups in Australia is this draw to the Bay Area in the US to raise capital, to tap into the deal making with Google and Yahoo and these sorts of guys, etc. So what do you think can be done to keep the innovation in Australia? Because let's be quite honest, the sorts of companies that you've got in your best in your winner list here aren't really known for their innovation in digital stuff. Fairfax, Telstra, who else have we got here? Foxtel, the ABC. These aren't really the names that I think of when I think of innovation in the digital space.
Maybe not, but they're the ones that are large enough and have sort of the distribution channels and everything else that goes into making their products sort of successful and work in this sort of market. In terms of innovation within Australia, I mean, you and I were both at the Remix conference recently and having a look, I had a look at the sort of all the WebJam mashup stuff. Some of which wasn't particularly commercially viable, but there's no shortage of innovation. It's, I guess, the size of the market here brings with it inherent constraints on what you can do, one of which is being the access to capital. The access to the audience locally is not that huge. And it's very hard to replicate what I consider to be a fairly unique environment that you find in the Bay Area in the US. To somewhere, to introduce something like to Australia in a sort of fairly quick turnaround time. So it's not just the digital media area. People have been going offshore with IT products and all sorts of stuff for a long, long time, basically chasing sort of where the money and the target market is. On the flip side of that, you've got companies like Atlassian,
yep,
which is a classic sort of little Aussie startup with a couple of young guys. Turning over, I think it was $80 million a year, what it was at the moment.
Yep.
But they had to go offshore to get that sort of scale, to get access to those sort of markets. So another way to look at it is great export opportunity. And you think about an Aussie male or a LookSmart going overseas and raising capital because they can't do it here. Another way to look at it is think of all those American dollars that then flew back into Australia and were invested locally.
Yeah, but that tends to be with the startup scenarios. It tends to not be the way it happens. I mean, the way it tends to happen these days is you have the Omni Drives or the Tanglers. Alas, is an exception. But these guys that pretty much are going over and Minty is the most recent one going over and basically saying, okay, well, we're now a San Francisco corporation.
Look,
and Australia misses out. We don't get the jobs don't go here, the money doesn't go here, it doesn't flow back into the economy here at all.
Yeah, look, again, need to be a little bit realistic about this. The countries like they have the same problem with a smaller population basis and with less access to capital. I mean, that's not to say there's not an awful lot to be done in this area here. It's one of the reasons that AMIA spends so much time sort of jumping around with investment, skills, education and training. But we're never going to completely stop the flow of ideas and people overseas because that's just where the big projects and the opportunity and the money always is and has been long before digital media was ever invented. I look at the publishing industry as a classic example of that. So there are certain things that we should do here and need to do here to make it a better environment to keep more people and ideas located here, but realistically, there are always going to be bigger markets which offer more opportunity than we can in Australia. I think we need to focus in Australia on the fact that we are definitely very innovative, but back to your original point, have a very sort of global outlook about the marketplace that we're actually attempting to get into.
Yeah, I guess that's when you talk about, think of it as an export opportunity or, there are bigger markets. It's funny because the fact that 88-90% of my audience is outside of Australia, I don't feel like I'm exporting. I just feel like I'm running a business and I have a global market with a global audience. My hosts are global. Our advertisers are global.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, it just seems to be an accident of history that I live in Melbourne. I don't think of it as export. It's just that's where the business is, right?
No, you're running a global company and ideally it shouldn't matter where you are, but you sort of answered your question yourself there, which is there's still a tendency for people to think they have to start off in the domestic market and then slowly sort of go globally. And I would argue you're exporting Australian content, full stop. you know, there's people that are consuming it overseas.
But only a small percentage of our content comes out of Australia. I mean, the vast majority of our content is produced in the US or the UK.
Let me ask you a question then. With all these international advertisers you've got, where does the money go?
Where does it go?
So you get paid for advertising.
Yep. So it ends its way up into the TPN bank account via PayPal. Goes into PayPal, it goes into then the TPN bank account, and then it gets redispersed back out to my hosts who live around the world.
Okay, so but I'm presuming that a percentage of what you earn is actually retained by the podcast network?
Some of it stays here for the time being, but only until I move to San Francisco or whatever.
You know? So technically you're an exporter. There's product going overseas being paid for, and there's money coming back into Australia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for the time being, that's absolutely right. But I guess I was just wondering from an AMIA perspective, as you guys are about the growth and success of the interactive media industry, if you see anything on the horizon that's going to make it more attractive to run a global media business out of Australia, because today at the moment it's not. I mean, if I had my time over again, I would have moved to San Francisco 2.5 years ago, probably.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the obvious thing is the state of our broadband infrastructure and our international links, which is always going to be a barrier to global competitiveness and being part of a global economy, and just physical difference. I mean, we can talk about you should be able to run a company from anywhere in the world. That's true. But we're never going to do away with the benefits of human interaction. That's why people still go to business meetings. That's why you and I still go to conferences. And that's very true from a business perspective. So I mean, we suffer a bit from being a very
tyranny
far away.
Of distance. The old tyranny of distance thing,
Yeah, there's a tyranny of distance aspect. We've got a small market. We feel that the broadband debate is possibly one of the most important ones that's going to happen for this industry ever. Because in a few years' time, when we're still running around with, relatively slow speeds and caps and everything, and the rest of the sort of developed world has got something immensely better, of course you're going to go and set yourself up overseas. So the money's there, the market's there, and there's better infrastructure. Singapore's proving this at the moment.
The bigger challenges, though, I think, broadband's definitely an issue, but the bigger challenges are access to capital and access to talent and access to support services. I mean, if I think of, from a media company perspective, if my audience was entirely in Australia, if our 500,000 listeners was entirely in Australia, I'm sure we would get a lot more traction with local media buyers, with the E. Mitches and the Starcoms and the Mojos, etc. But the fact that it's dispersed globally means that the industry support just isn't there. I mean, these guys just aren't geared up to think about a global operation and a global marketplace. So it's I think more of those issues that tend to drive businesses like mine offshore.
Yep. Look, you're absolutely right. And again, it comes without wishing to denigrate this fine country. I mean, we're still a small market, and traditionally industry structures have been built around countries.
Yeah.
Europe's an absolutely classic case. Yeah. Where it's a continent, continental Europe's not much bigger than Australia, and yet it's got all these different languages and different, even with one common, the EU, there's still a whole bunch of regional differences there that make it quite hard to say we're just going to service Europe from one spot with one product and one campaign. It'll take a while for those barriers to break down and for sort of the broader business community to stop thinking that way. Again, industry's only 12 years old. A lot of this stuff, a lot of these business models are still evolving for people. The thing we should be doing is planning for the fact that in due course, as soon as we can push it, I mean, there will start to be breakthroughs in global businesses operating globally. I mean, yours is actually one of the sort of the exceptions to the rule at the moment, because of all these constraints, and yet you're still running into this problem with you can't find somebody to rep you globally, and you can't find global advertisers.
Oh, we can, but we're doing it all ourselves.
Felt, yeah.
you know, it's all direct. You know, we've got relationships forming with ad sales companies in the US and the UK. But I sit here all the time thinking, well, there is absolutely no reason why, you know, I shouldn't be able to talk to a Mojo or a Starcom or any of these guys who should, or an Ad to One that shouldn't be able to do this for us on a global basis. They're a global operation, a lot of these businesses. They have global reach. Why can't they take care of this for us globally?
They may have global reach, but I think you'll find that each of them is operating quite locally.
Yeah, they are. That's absolutely right. And they're dealing with local marketing directors and local marketing managers. Yep. Well, so you can't help.
Not directly. Can I fix a problem for you today, Cameron? No.
No.
I mean, part of our role in all this, though, is to, I guess, keep shoving in their faces that this is all changing. Unfortunately, you know, people don't like change, and they get frightened of it. And from an external perspective, this whole digital thing looks pretty scary. And it requires companies to reinvent themselves, which is expensive and upsets shareholders. And you know, there's a lot of short-term interest coming to play in times like this, which is why you see so much resistance to change. And the record industry, the music industry, has demonstrated this abundantly and still can't get its head around the fact that the world has changed. Now, they're an extreme case because they got hurt early. But I think once you start to see the rise of sort of renegade global marketing and advertising companies that aren't based anywhere, you'll see the industry start to change pretty quickly from an advertising perspective.
So just to wrap up, mate, what are your forecasts for what we're going to see in the Australian industry over the next couple of years? You obviously think broadband is going to be one of the key issues. Anything else that's going to be hot?
I tend not to sort of think in sort of product terms or what's hot and what's not, because my job's to think a bit sort of from that. The biggest problem I see, and it's not even access to capital, it's just that the whole skills and training issue that we have at the moment. Now, we're a bit unique in Australia in that we have full employment to start with. We've got a relatively young industry that, you know, looks pretty sexy. But what we're getting is people coming into the industry who are relatively sort of unskilled or not well trained, and as a result, businesses find it difficult because it holds them back when they've got to sit back and actually teach people how the digital, you know, sort of value chain works for whichever part of the industry they're in. So our next big push is in the skills and training side of things, to really try and skill people up quickly for a digital future. Because the industry is growing quite rapidly, but we don't have enough people who are trained and ready to start work the day they walk into the office. And it's not unique Australian, but because we've got full employment at the moment, it's probably even bigger than the access to capital. Because, you know, so capital's one thing, but you need good people.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of good people in Bangladesh, man. Most of us are getting them out of there.
Yeah, that's, again, you know, there's different arguments and positives and negatives to all that. I mean, Australia has become, or has been in the past, the sort of Bangladesh of the film industry, because we were comparatively cheap for our special effects type work, so a little was done here. It was considered a great thing at the time. Not great if you're a special effects company over in the US, because you've lost all your business to these cheap Australians, yep. And then the Kiwis did it to us.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, it's not new, and you'd like to think that, yeah, okay, a certain percentage of this work is going to go offshore where it's cheaper. So are we going to sort of get terribly upset about that, or we sort of think about sort of being innovative and the ideas we have and worry less about sort of doing all the grunt coding work here?
You on Twitter?
Deliberately not.
Facebook?
Again, particularly after the explosion of Facebook invites in the last couple of weeks. No, I tend to stick to LinkedIn and Second Life for social networking opportunities.
You're in Second Life. What's your nick in Second Life?
Viscount Swindlehurst.
How much time do you spend in Second Life?
That's the interesting thing, is not very much. I mean, with a lot of these Web 2.0 products and social networking tools, you really got to have a bit of time to invest in them to use them well. And when I look at LinkedIn and Orkut and Second Life and all the invitations to join Facebook, it's any sort of community or any sort of social network. If you don't invest time in it, you don't get very much back out of it. So it's all well and good these things springing up all over the place because there is a demographic that definitely does have time for it. My demographic struggles to find the time to put the effort into of them.
What's your demographic, John?
The mortgage, two kids, works too many hours a week. And the last thing he wants to do is spend more time in front of the computer when he gets home demographic.
Are you considering running AMI or events in Second Life at some stage?
No. I've been asked this by journalists a few times because other industry bodies have popped up doing, sort of setting up their own sort of shop fronts and what have you. We've, at the moment, of a view from that our members seem to like the actual physical interaction with us.
Getting pissed, really.
Sorry?
Getting pissed.
There's always that aspect to it. And sometimes, well, when I started, I used to worry that AMI was a drinking club with an association problem. But I think about, we do a lot of business forums, usually in the mornings, and time after time after time, these sell out. And yet we'll go and run the podcasts and the vodcasts online with almost no interest. So we're definitely providing something that involves, you know, a physical social interaction in real life that people enjoy. Now, the resources required to then translate that over into a Second Life experience, it would be fun to do for the novelty of it. Do I think it's the best way of servicing our members in the industry here at the moment? No. Mm-hmm. That may come later when there's genuine demand for it. But at the moment, I see things like Second Life as being where, you know, our members should be operating, but not that the industry body needs to sort of communicate with its members through that as a channel, just simply from an allocation of resources perspective.
So you do have some podcasts up there that people can tune into?
We do. They're mostly sort of behind the members-only side of things. It's one of the member benefits.
Okay. Pay $175 and you get access to the podcasts.
And a whole bunch of other things, including chatting to me.
You get to chat to John. All right, mate, well, it's good to catch up.
Likewise, Cameron.
Haven't seen you for 10 years, man. Until we
there we go. I'm delighted to see that you've managed to turn the podcast network into what it is. And yes, you are an export success story, whether you like it or not.
Well, you know, unfortunately, we'll probably end up being an export, a complete export, which is unfortunate because, you know, I like Australia and I like living in Australia. I'd like to see more stuff stay in this country, but the environment's not quite here yet.
It's not quite here yet, and it's going to be still a tricky environment for a while yet. Certainly Amy's got a lot of work to do in this area. To try and make it a better environment. But as I said, a lot of it's structural, a lot of it's to do with the market size. And it's been that way for a long time, so it's all a question about shortcuts at the moment to try and get around it.
Thank you, John Butterworth.
Thank you, Cameron Riley.
Well, kids, that's all for me for at least a week. I'm going to take a break for about a week. I'll be coming back around about the 25th of July. We'll no doubt have a bunch of shows crammed together before the end of July. So enjoy your time without me. Check out some more of the shows on the podcast network and go back and have a listen to some of the archives in G'day World. We've done nearly 300 shows, probably over 300 shows now over the last couple of years, if you include all of the ones that didn't fit in with the original or the current numbering system. And there's some great ones there. Go back and listen to Ray Kurzweil, Noam Chomsky, Doc Searls, Dave Weinberger, John Romero, some of the highlight done with some of the bigger thinkers, bigger visionaries that we've been fortunate enough to have on the show. And we'll have some more kick-ass interviews coming back in a couple of weeks. This is Cameron out.